We'll hear arguments next in Bell against Wolfish. I think you may proceed when you're ready now.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, this case is here on writ of certiorari to the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit to review certain aspects of its decision relating to conditions of confinement at the Metropolitan Correctional Center, a federally operated short-term custodial facility in New York City. There are five issues presented to you for decision. The first, and perhaps potentially the most significant from the standpoint of constitutional doctrine, involves the constitutionality of double bunking pretrial detainees in rooms designed for single occupancy.
Mr. Fryer, when you say pretrial detainees, I take it you are excluding those who are confined other than in a status as pretrial detainees.
That's right. There are various classifications of inmates that are kept at a facility like the MCC, in addition to persons who are being held in lieu of bail awaiting trial on criminal charges. There is a significant group of inmates who have been brought in on ad testificandum or ad prosequendum writs to appear in federal court proceedings, who are prisoners serving other state or federal sentences. There are persons awaiting parole and probation revocation hearings, and there are sentenced inmates whose sentences are such a short duration that it's deemed desirable to have them serve their sentence in New York.
Well, all those categories of people are people who have been convicted and sentenced to confinement.
That's correct.
And since the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit did not find that this was in any way cruel and unusual punishment, and no appeal was taken from that, those people are out of the case, aren't they?
As to the double bunking issue.
Yeah, double bunking business.
That's correct.
Yeah.
They are out of the case.
Now, as to the people who will remain there, who are awaiting trial, by definition, they have not been able to secure release on bail.
The group of people that we're talking about in connection with the double bunking issue are people who have been unable to secure release on bail. Is there any difference in the facility?
I know it's new and all, but is it the same group of people?
I believe it is generally the same group of people. Actually, there may be some categories that were kept at West Street and that were shifted to other facilities when the MCC opened because of the population increase of people committed to the Bureau's custody, immigration, deportation cases and others.
Are the people being held because they either were not allowed to put up bail or couldn't do it, those who've been indicted for felonies, or are there some people charged with misdemeanors?
I don't know the record. I simply don't know the answer to that question.
Mr. Fry, before you get into your argument, if this were a state facility, the cause of action would be brought under 1983, I would suppose. Have you given any thought to what's the source of the cause of action that's asserted in this case? I know that's not really your responsibility, but I just be interested in your...
Well, it was brought as a habeas corpus class action, certified as a class action. We have not challenged the jurisdiction. We contested the wisdom of certifying a class action, but that was done, and we have not challenged that in this court.
Do you agree that these issues are properly raisable in a habeas corpus proceeding?
Well, I have not focused my attention in preparing the argument on that question. I'm not prepared to dispute.
This struck me as somewhat anomalous. I was trying to think it through myself, and I didn't know if the government had a position on that.
Well, one that I could state.
Have we any history of habeas corpus class actions that you're familiar with?
Well, I believe there is some authority for habeas corpus class actions, and there have been questions that have come to our attention in the Solicitor General's office in connection with whether that should be challenged, but to this point we have not
sought to challenge the propriety of that, and we don't do it in this case.
It's more on a basic question. Didn't the Prizer case hold that when all of it is challenged are the conditions of confinement, by contrast with the fact of confinement, that habeas corpus is inappropriate? That habeas corpus is appropriate only to secure release, in other words.
I'm not sure that that's correct, but I am generally familiar,
but I have not refreshed myself on it. But it was a while ago.
Well, in Middendorf against Henry, which is October term 75, I think the opinion of the court expressly reserved the propriety of the question as to whether a habeas corpus action could be a class action. I don't think this court has ever approved it.
I haven't suggested that this court has, but I don't think... I don't perceive of that as the kind of threshold jurisdictional question that you must decide, even though we have not brought it to you for decision.
Well, the class action is one thing, but the basic availability of habeas corpus is more fundamental. That's jurisdictional, isn't it?
Well, I think that would be right, and I'm not sure. Perhaps my colleague can answer. There may be alternative grounds, such as mandamus, for
enforcement. Your colleague's the one who brought the lawsuit, or rather his client did.
The question I thought my brother did is, do you agree that there is habeas for conditions?
Well, I think my answer is that we have not asked this court to overturn the judgment below on the grounds that there is a lack of jurisdiction or on grounds of any challenge to the propriety of a class action certification. And I am reluctant to state a position for the government on these issues without having given it a great deal of thought.
Well, one way would be, if we rule against you, then you...
then you'd have your position.
In any event,
did you say, if I met, what percentage of the total population is represented in the class
pre-trial detainees? Well, the class consists of the total population of inmates, both sentenced and pretrial detainees.
Oh, I see.
I think that there are some internal conflicts of interest between this group, but our request to have separate subclasses certified was denied by the district court. And
so we have the whole population?
You have the whole population, but not as to every issue. The double bunking issue, the disposition in the Court of Appeals was that it reversed the district court's ban as applied to sentenced inmates and remanded for further proceedings. It affirmed as applied to pretrial detainees because it perceived that a different legal standard was appropriate to judge the claim in that context. There are also four rules or practices that are before this court that are justified on security grounds. The right to receive packages, the so-called publisher-only rule, the validity of visual inspection of body cavities after contact visits, and the right to be present, of the inmate to be present and observe room searches. Now,
and these issues concern the whole class.
With the exception of the room search issue, which applies only to pretrial detainees, no distinction was drawn on the other three issues between sentenced inmates and pretrial detainees. Arguably, one might be, but none has been. Now, these five issues are the rump contingent of a veritable army of complaints about the operation of the MCC that marched into the United States District Court in November 1975, less than 4 months after the MCC opened. The issues raised covered such diverse subjects as housing, food, clothing of inmates, visiting, library facilities, staffing, educational and job opportunities, grievance procedures, mail, telephone service, noise levels, various aspects of the treatment of personal property, and many others too numerous to name here. After initially resolving a few of the issues on summary judgment, including the double bunking and the publisher-only issue, the district court conducted hearings and issued an extensive opinion granting much of the relief respondents sought and denying others of their claims. The court relied on both constitutional and statutory grounds for its decision. Some of its rulings the government acquiesced in, others were appealed to the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals, in turn, affirmed in part and reversed in part. It rejected any statutory basis for the district court's orders prohibiting various MCC practices and conditions, finding that the case generally involved matters committed to agency discretion by law. It accordingly rested its own ruling solely on constitutional grounds. As I've said, in setting forth the constitutional standards, it distinguished between sentenced inmates and pretrial detainees. As to the former, challenge conditions were to be judged by the Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment standard. For detainees, the court relied on the presumption of innocence to set a much higher standard. It stated that pretrial detainees may be subject to, quote, only those restrictions and privations which inhere in their confinement itself or which are justified by compelling necessities of jail administration, close quote. And it made quite clear that challenges to conditions of confinement for detainees are to be adjudicated without consideration of either fiscal or administrative justifications for the particular practice. And it applied these standards to the double bunking issue by, in effect, adopting a per se rule that two inmates may not be housed in a room designed for one. With regard to the other issues that are before this court, the Court of Appeals acknowledged that the maintenance of security and order is a compelling necessity of jail administration, but it nevertheless concluded that the government had failed to establish sufficient justification for the practices or rules in question. Now, as I indicated at the beginning, the case breaks down into two different types of issues. The first involves the standards by which the due process rights of pretrial detainees are to be evaluated in the context of a challenge to alleged overcrowding at the MCC. The second involves the security-related issues. Now, since the first issue is potentially the more novel and substantial constitutional issue, I intend to devote most or all of my limited time to that question and to rely on the briefs for the other issues. I'd like to say a brief word about the MCC itself before getting into the legal arguments. It is one of a very limited number of federal facilities specifically designed to house pretrial detainees and other short-term inmates. As the Court of Appeals described it, the MCC represented the architectural embodiment of the best and most progressive penological planning. The key design element of the MCC that's relevant to the double bunking issue, and that indeed is the central element of the facility, is the modular unit concept. In this concept, there are self-contained residential units in lieu of the traditional cell block. A typical unit contains 48 rooms, which adjoin large multi-purpose rooms with facilities for recreation, education, exercise, and dining. The common areas are carpeted. The sleeping rooms have doors rather than bars. And for virtually the entire day, except 7 sleeping hours between 11 at night and 6 in the morning, the inmates are free to move about their unit without restriction. Also, visiting facilities are attached to each of these units rather than having a central facility for the institution. I understand that there are slides in the record with photographs of the institution if you deem it useful to get a look at what it's like. The MCC was designed to house 449 inmates. However, contemporaneous with its opening in August 1975, there was a sharp and unexpected increase in the number of persons committed to the Bureau of Prisons custody who the Bureau determined had to be or should be housed at the MCC. Because the number of inmates exceeded the design capacity of the institution, the Bureau determined, in order to meet its custodial obligations, that a number of the rooms should be used to house two inmates and that bunk beds should replace single beds in the dormitory areas. Accordingly, bunk beds were installed in place of single beds in 73 of the 389 residential rooms at the MCC. Now, the respondents have invoked and the Court of Appeals has relied upon the Due Process Clause for striking down the double bunking in this case. The focus of the issue, therefore, concerns the substantive content of that clause. The Court of Appeals held that the Due Process Clause, by its own force and without the aid of any other constitutional provision, confers upon pretrial detainees the right to be free of cramped housing conditions in the absence of a governmental showing of compelling necessity.
Was that a liberty interest or a property interest?
I believe they viewed it as a liberty interest. And we do not dispute in this case that pretrial detainees retain those liberty interests that are not inconsistent with the fact of confinement itself. We simply dispute that the standard that was applied by the Court of Appeals in evaluating the practices that arguably impinged upon those liberty interests was the right standard. Now, we think that the Court of Appeals standard lacks any basis in the constitutional decisions of this court dealing with the subject of substantive due process. And we think that the proper resolution of the issue that was before the Court of Appeals required that the government be afforded an opportunity to adduce the factors that brought about the challenged conditions and the propriety of the government's action, having to be assessed by its reasonableness in relation to the legitimate governmental objectives at stake. Now, two aspects of the constitutional backdrop to this issue are worth highlighting. First, there is no dispute that the conditions of confinement for both pretrial detainees and sentenced inmates must meet minimum levels of decency with regard to such considerations as housing, food, sanitation, and medical care. And we've spelled out in our brief the reasons for our contention that these standards have been fully satisfied at the MCC.
You say there's no dispute that they must, and you mean constitutionally they
constitutionally.
Must.
Because of the
cruel and unusual punishment clause.
And as to pretrial detainees, the due process clause.
What's the due process clause?
What does that have to do with it?
Well, it has to do with it in the same sense, I think, that conditions of this kind can be viewed as cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment. We are in agreement that pretrial detainees cannot, under the due process clause, be punished prior to
can't
a trial.
At all, can they?
Well, after conviction, when they cease being pretrial detainees.
But you said pretrial detainees.
They can't be punished. That's
at all.
That's correct.
Not only cruel and unusually punished, they can't be punished at all, can they?
That's true, but...
And that is a matter of due process, you say.
Yes, we agree. Right.
So then is the standard that you suggest one that if we were to conclude that a particular type of treatment really had to be classified as punishment, then that would violate the due process clause?
Yeah.
Didn't have to be cruel and unusual, but yeah. Just as long
if
as
if you concluded that it was punishment, then it would violate the due process clause. Now, we have a great deal of difficulty with the respondent's argument that what was involved in this case was demonstrated to be punishment. We think the concept of punishment as they're using it is a trivial or tautological concept. It's punishment because they repeatedly say it's punishment.
What do you call incarceration?
What do I call incarceration?
If it's not punishment, what is it?
Well, if it's not punishment, it's custody. It can be incarceration, of course, can be punishment.
But if it is inevitably punishment, then there could be no pretrial detainees.
Well, that's... And if that's the case, then the Due Process Clause allows punishment to the extent that pretrial...
It doesn't allow punishment of anybody who's not been convicted of a criminal offense.
No, but I think we're getting into a circularity. I don't think there's any substantial dispute.
If it is punishment, there can be no such thing as a pretrial detainee.
Yes,
everybody would have to be released.
No one is questioning the validity of the institution of pretrial detention.
So then doesn't your right to detain have to depend on a finding that these people were found not likely to show up for their trials upon furnishing of bail, therefore you had to detain them in order to assure their presence at trial?
Well, the detention involves an impairment of a fundamental liberty interest protected by the Due Process Clause, and the standard that the Court of Appeals applied to double bunking is clearly an appropriate standard to apply to pretrial commitment, and indeed both the Constitution and the statutes require a kind of least restrictive alternative test so that detention is the last step after you've excluded any other reasonable measure to assure presence at trial.
But if you've met all those tests, then you're depriving them of liberty simply in order to assure their presence at trial.
That is the purpose for which they're being...
I thought some of these people, at least, would have been released if they could have raised the bail.
That's true. I assume. I assume very few, if any.
You're not keeping them because they're people who wouldn't show up when they're supposed to show up. You're keeping them because even though they would show up, they couldn't afford.
Well, I don't think. I don't think that's right, because the amount of bail is set in the amount necessary to assure their appearance at trial, and if they don't post that amount, then it follows that there has been a determination that with some lesser amount or a personal recognizance bond, their appearance at trial cannot be assured, and that's the reason why they're...
No, but whatever the amount is, had they been able to raise it, they would have been released.
That's correct, but they would have then been deterred from fleeing or failing to appear by the...
Is what you've said applicable statutes on bail?
I believe it is. We cited the section 3146, I think, in our brief in terms of...
Doesn't there have to be some finding that some alternatives... besides bail, wouldn't...
There are considerations of a number of alternatives, money bail being low down on the
list. That isn't... What you said really doesn't cover what the kind of a determination that's been made. You have to arrive at some conclusion that other alternatives won't suffice to...
I agree with that. I'm not sure what the bearing of... I don't know what the bearing of that is in the context of this case, because... No one is contesting the validity of the institution of pretrial detention. No one is contesting. We're not contesting that a compelling necessity standard is appropriate, and the respondents are not contesting that these people can be detained. It's the subsidiary conditions of confinement incidental to this massive restriction on liberty that's involved in the detention that are at issue here.
But the purpose of the detention, it must have some bearing on the standard of review. If it's punishment, it's one thing. If it's simply assuring that they will show up for trial because there's no other way that you can assure their appearance, it may be another.
Well, let me explain the role that I think punishment properly plays in this. When a challenge is presented to a condition of confinement, the government is obliged, assuming the challenge crosses some constitutional threshold of presenting some kind of a claim of a liberty interest, the government is obliged to show in some fashion and by some standard a justification for the action that it has taken, which has impaired this interest. Now, in the case of a pretrial detainee, the government cannot say one of the reasons we're doing this is to punish them, or one of the reasons that justifies this practice is to rehabilitate them, or to deter others from committing the offense. Those are governmental objectives that can only be invoked to support a condition of confinement in the case of convicted inmates. In the case of pretrial detainees, there must be other kinds of considerations invoked. Our concern in this case is that the very real and substantial fiscal and administrative considerations that made it necessary to resort to a degree of double bunking were totally foreclosed from consideration by the court under a standard which in effect said per se you just can't put two people in a room that was designed for one, period. We don't want to hear why you're doing it. Now, in this connection, there is a lot of suggestion that fiscal considerations and administrative convenience are somehow insubstantial excuses that the government makes up to justify its practices, and that it's something, administrative convenience is something like not having to work overtime or not having to make modifications in established routines. And we think administrative convenience is much more in this context. The Bureau of Prisons has a certain population of inmates committed to its custody. It has no control over the number of these inmates. It has to house them. The kinds of considerations of administrative convenience which are included in this concept involve where are you going to put these people? If you can't double bunk in the MCC, then a number of people who perhaps should be in New York City, including, and it didn't happen in this case, but it could, pretrial detainees will be moved away from their family and friends, away from their lawyers.
You can't put them in the state facility in New York.
No, they're too. We could not. But this is the kind of issue that would have been explored at a trial.
And it is not simply administrative convenience of the administrators, but encompassed within this rubric is the welfare of the people committed to their custody as a group. And when the MCC was told you can't double bunk anymore, what happened was that 90 inmates who the Bureau of Prisons judged ought to be housed at the MCC were sent off to other facilities, possibly more crowded or for other reasons less suitable for them. Now, I do want to, I think, save the balance of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Mr. Chief Justice.
Mrs. Bamberger.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the government's application of the compelling interest test as the appropriate standard for determining the rights of pretrial detainees ignores the historical and legal context of that standard, and indeed the very facts of this case. Furthermore, the government misconstrues the Second Circuit's test. What we are dealing with here is the fundamental right of a pretrial detainee not to be punished. This right persists even though the pretrial detainee is placed in custody to assure his appearance in court at the time of trial. This fact of detention has not constitutionally been considered punishment because the Eighth Amendment permits bail and by inference permits custody in lieu of bail in order to assure the appearance of the defendant for trial.
Would you think, Mrs. Bamberger, that double bunking, as it's been described, is in itself punishment?
Double bunking, as the district judge saw it and found it, is an incident of punishment because it is not necessary in order to assure the appearance of the defendant at trial and for the security of the institution, which are the only two factors which can be considered in determining whether or not a condition of confinement that is above and beyond the fact of incarceration
would double bunking be a form of punishment in the military services, for example, in an army camp?
Well, we have to look at the
particular... They're detained under military discipline.
Are you talking about normal military conditions?
Army, Navy, Marine Corps?
Yes, Your Honor, there's a vast distinction between the governmental purpose in the military context and the governmental purpose here.
No, I'm talking about double bunking. Now, you say you're supporting the idea that double bunking is per se punishment.
Oh, no, Your Honor. Indeed,
well,
we're not. We're saying that overcrowding, which was in part caused by double bunking in this case.
Well, was the overcrowding caused by double bunking or the double bunking caused by overcrowding?
No. Well, there would have been no overcrowding if there had been no double bunking. The government has never indicated on the facts of this case an inability to comply with the district court's order. They have been in compliance for 2 years without a single request for a stay, without returning to the courts for relief from the order prohibiting double bunking.
How do you define overcrowding?
Okay, we define it for purposes of this case as the district court saw it and as he made findings. We have two people housed in a cell which the judge found was built for one. The results of this housing of two people in a cell built for one was that there was a very small space for movement of the two people. He looked at it and he saw there was a very narrow aisle. Secondly, it requires urination and defecation in the close presence of the other person with the resulting discomforts, which the judge described
in
his opinion.
I don't mean to be anecdotal, but the troop ship I came back from the Second World War had bunks stacked six high in the hold of a ship. And I don't think the common view then was that it was a form of punishment or that it was necessarily overcrowding given the circumstances.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that is a point which can be easily explained. The government's compelling interest in wartime is far different from the government's compelling interest as it exists with the detention of presumptively innocent detainees. The purpose of the wartime confinement was to create a fighting unit which could defend the government, which could defend this country.
Well, if you go into some military camps right today, when we are in no war, you will find a considerable amount of double bunking.
Indeed, Your Honor, and the conditions of confinement in a military camp, even in normal times, can be justified by the government because of the government's need to create a unified fighting force capable of taking orders and directions and indeed in wartime conditions living under very severe restrictions and conditions. That's not true here. The government's compelling interest is limited to making sure that the individual shows up for court and for protecting the security of the institution. And the government does not claim, and indeed it never has, that overcrowding by double bunking in this case is justified by anything other than cost and convenience.
Well, maybe not providing each pretrial detainee a suite of rooms is not necessary to assure he's showing up at trial, or not providing each one a private bathroom.
No, that's...
I don't understand the connection.
The connection in this case, Your Honor, is that the conditions which were imposed resulted in a severe loss of privacy and dignity, as the judge found on the specific facts in this case.
Well, so arguably, would depriving somebody of a suite of rooms and a private bathroom.
Yes, but there are admittedly limitations.
There are, aren't there?
Yes, there are limitations, and that's why this is not a per se case. That's why
Is it a per se case, even with respect to the class? Now, by definition, these people are impoverished people, or else they could have made bail and been out, released on bond. Wouldn't it be necessary to compare their living conditions before they were in this facility with their living conditions in the facility?
Well,
some might be better, some might be worse, and some might be arguably about the same.
That may very well be true, Your Honor, but this is an imposed condition, a condition imposed by the government. Also, in a free atmosphere, the individual would be free to pick himself and go to another street, or take a bus, or go to a museum, or
well,
a library.
That you concede cannot be allowed to these people, don't you? Don't you concede the legitimacy of pretrial detention?
Yes, we do concede that. Well, what we're saying is that they are confined to this very small space. We can go. The judge went further than just looking at the single cells with the exposed toilet and the excretory functions performed in the presence of another, and the use of the bunk bed, which on one wall causes cold air to blow in on the person sleeping on the top bunk, so that his freedom of movement is restricted. And if you shifted the bunk bed to the opposite wall, one end of the bed would be blocking the window.
Couldn't
in the
he put a blanket
wall.
On?
They did put a blanket on it, and what the judge found was that as a result of that, the ventilation system was not functioning properly.
This isn't supposed to be a spa. It's a prison.
Well, we're not urging that it should be a spa. What we're urging is that in these conditions, on these facts, the individuals were deprived, and the judge found, of minimal privacy and dignity. The Court of Appeals agreed.
Bunk bed's punishment. Because if so, I'm going to apologize to my sons.
No.
Would I not be obliged to?
Yes, you would, except if he lived in a room like this, where if he slept in the top bunk, he would be unable to move. And if he slept in the bottom bunk with a bunk bed in the room...
What do you mean he couldn't move?
Because the air vent blew cold air right across the top of the inmate's body on the top bunk bed, so that his movement was restricted. He couldn't lift his legs, he couldn't turn over, he couldn't prop himself up against the wall because his body was...
Because of his size, but everybody wasn't that big.
No, it would be because,
Your
Honor...
Well, I mean, it might be cruel and inhuman to put me in with another guy my size. How about 225-pound fellows? Is that punishment for them?
Well,
Is it?
It would be if they couldn't move in the room.
If the room, this size room, and they had 225-pound guys in it.
Well, we're free to leave this room.
No, they can move around in that room.
Yes, we could, but the judge found that they couldn't move around in that room.
Regardless of their size.
You
mean the wall shrunk?
No, it meant that after there was the desk and the two chairs, which the second chair had to be put in because there was a second person, and the bunk bed, that the room, that the aisle was too narrow for them to move around, that they couldn't leave each other's company in any way, that they were forced to remain together all the time, and that within a few inches of each other, they had to use the toilet facility, and that if the bed was not placed on the wall with the vent, it would be placed on the opposite wall where...
Lack of private toilet punishment?
Not if... not per se. How the private toilet existed in this case was that there was no room for the person not using the toilet to remove himself from, for any distance except several inches or perhaps...
With this, I'm true. My whole point is that I understand the government's position is that they weren't permitted to show anything.
That, Your Honor,
well,
not is
anything not... anything but close to it.
The record in this case disputes that. The government filed several sets of affidavits. I believe what the government is contesting in this case is that they were not given the opportunity to present their cost and justification, cost and inconvenience justifications. As a matter of law, if the fundamental right not to be punished is infringed upon here by the conditions of confinement, cost and inconvenience is simply legally irrelevant. Even under the government's enhanced scrutiny test, cost and inconvenience cannot be the sole factor.
Well, what would you do in the meantime while you're building a new facility?
That question doesn't come up here because the government has never asserted that
a new
facility...
Is there a new facility available?
The government's never asserted the need for one. Here, on appeal, in the district court, the government has
the right... Well, I don't see how the government can show anything when the court takes the position that two people in one cell is bad and denial of due process, period.
No, but they didn't say that.
What did they say?
The court said that with the functional unit system, which was used by the Bureau of Prisons for this institution, the institution could not service a population which was in excess of the population for which the institution was built, 449.
Well, doesn't that require a new institution?
No, it doesn't require a new institution.
Well, doesn't it require another institution or turn them loose?
Not on this record. There's no indication
of
that.
Well, how else would you handle it on this or any other record?
The Court of Appeals found that the government handled it simply by removing from the institution those inmates who were serving their sentences but were kept at the institution as part of a workforce for the government's own convenience.
Mrs. Bamberger, that leads me to ask a question that's been on my mind. I gathered somewhere in these briefs, which I read it a good time ago, Christmas time, that there's been a change in the situation since this litigation was commenced, and that there's now considerably less, if indeed any, overcrowding in this facility. Am I mistaken about that?
Well, the government has been in compliance with the court's full order on overcrowding since August 28, 1978, and they have never returned to the court with proof, with assertions, with facts which would indicate that they are incapable of maintaining that. In fact, they conceded in their brief that they're capable of maintaining.
And the fact is that there's now no overcrowding of the kind about which you complained. Is that correct?
As far as I understand it, that should be... Well, the government says that they should be relieved of the obligations because... the situation may come up again.
Well, it may, but it's disappeared now, hasn't it? Haven't they changed their policies? Don't they no longer keep in custody here the workforce?
They no longer keep in custody.
Why isn't the case moot?
Well, I think, Your Honor, with all due respect, has to ask the government whether their statement in their brief that they intend to overcrowd...
Thank you, Mr. Justice, I will.
Well, if you comply with an injunction... presumably, to avoid contempt, you can nonetheless appeal.
Exactly, Your Honor. But the point is the government did not seek a stay of the double-selling or the overcrowding double-selling order. They never have.
But that isn't a prerequisite to avoidance of mootness.
There are two more factors involved here. First, they have never returned to the district court claiming impossibility or that they have to construct a new institution or that there's been a substantial change in facts which requires them to be relieved of their obligations under the order.
Well, those may support your contention here that the order was proper, but I don't see how they support the contention that the case is moot because the court ordered the government to do something that it didn't want to do voluntarily. The government complied with that order under the threat of contempt sanction and appeal.
Yes,
it's conceivable that the case could become moot. If this place had burned down and there were no more MCA, the case would probably be moot, wouldn't it?
Yes, that's correct. But it's the government's position here that leaves it open because they say that if they have a lot of prisoners again, that they will put them in the institution, convicted, non-convicted, pretrial, whatever it may be.
Ms. Bamberger, please don't push the point that it's moot because of his moot, your injunction is
gone. No, I'm not pushing that it's moot. What I am urging, Your Honor...
Well, it's word to word.
I'm urging, Your Honor, is that we have a situation here which the government claims is capable of repetition. And we are urging that this order is proper on that assertion. To return to the question of the government's compliance, the district court included in its order a provision which would permit the warden of the institution to certify that he needed to overcrowd because of an emergency or immediate severe overcrowding. The government has never availed itself of that portion of the order.
Isn't the government's position as a matter of law that it is entitled to act on its own without going to the district court and asking for a certificate?
It doesn't have to go to the court. It just has to file a copy of its own certification with the court.
Well, isn't its position that it doesn't have to be subjected to that sort of requirement?
Its position is that, but even though that order is in effect now, the prohibition on overcrowding is in effect now, while the case is before this court, they haven't used that remedy.
Well, but if they feel the remedy is improperly imposed as a matter of constitutional law, I suppose they have a right to appeal, even though you suggest they have perhaps an easier out by simply complying with the order, but that doesn't moot the case.
No, we're not asserting that the case is moot. We're just saying that there is no factual assertion in this record for the government's justification that cost and inconvenience permit the overcrowded housing that existed in this facility at the time that this case was tried. That those conditions, those justifications...
How can cost or inconvenience have anything to do with the question of whether the particular condition is punishment or not?
That's what I want to know.
Well, that's the government's theory, and I don't understand that, because if it's...
I mean, either it's punishment or not. If it is punishment, it seems to me they concede they'd have to spend whatever money is necessary to remove the punishment.
That's exactly the point.
So why are we fighting about money?
Well...
I don't understand.
With that, I will move on to one
you
additional...
Tell us before you move on to that, will you tell me, at least, what authority the district court or the court of appeals relied upon to say that the ancient remedy of habeas corpus is a class action? Could be used under a class action umbrella.
There have been decisions which I don't have in my head at this moment, Your Honor, in the Florida and California federal courts involving capital punishment sanction, in which those cases decided the issues based upon class action status.
Was it a habeas?
I believe, Your Honor, that they were habeas corpus proceedings. Habeas corpus has been used by the courts and the Second Circuit. For instance, I cite Sastre against McGinnis. To release an individual not necessarily from full custody, but from those conditions which are unconstitutional.
Well, but in a class action, that's all I'm addressing myself to now.
I believe that there are cases which I will be happy to supply the court with. The one additional fact which the court considered in the overcrowding issue, which was the entire setup of the functional unit system, where inmates had to spend virtually 23 hours of every day in that one functional unit. And Mr. Fry described for the court that it meant that the inmates were confined to this area for virtually all activities. Now, what the judge found was that the institution couldn't supply the activities which these multi-purpose functional unit rooms were supposed to supply because of the overcrowding. And this resulted in a breakdown in the functioning of the institution.
Ms. Bamberger, what if the place had been designed originally so that the sleeping rooms were to house two people in exactly the way that the government ultimately ended up housing them, but the other facilities had met the standards that you think they ought to meet, so that it wasn't a question of later putting in more people than they were designed for, but just designing more closely confined sleeping room? Do you think that would be unconstitutional?
I think that would present a more difficult case.
Why?
Well, because the conditions in the room, the denial of privacy, the cold air blowing in the vent, the presence of the exposed toilet would still exist.
Well, supposing that was all present, but it was simply designed that way. The government just decided to put twice as many people, but it was that was the architect's plan.
Well, if that was the architect's plan, I would submit that the court could disregard the architect's plan, just as the court could consider it as an element in deciding whether the room was appropriate for housing more than one person.
So it isn't a question of going beyond what the capacity of the prison was originally supposed to house. It's a question of some standard that a court gets from somewhere as to how many square feet each prisoner should have, regardless of what the architect planned.
That's correct. And indeed, the Bureau of Prisons has presented testimony in cases which would indicate that 50 square feet is the minimum required per inmate in a cell in order to give him adequate movement space, adequate psychological space. That testimony is cited in Campbell against Magruder by the D.C. Circuit. The draft standards proposed by the Justice Department indicate that the space which was provided per inmate in this double-celling, overcrowding situation is inadequate.
Do you think those are absorbed into the Constitution?
I don't think that they are absorbed into the Constitution, but I suggest to the court that they are valid evidence which can be considered expert evidence from, in the case of the government draft standards, its own correctional officials, which would indicate what they believe to be adequate. And I think that is evidence which the district court considered and which is appropriate to consider in making an evaluation. It's the same way as in a medical case. Doctors' assertions are not constitutional principles, but they are relevant evidence in determining what is the proper legal standard to apply.
Ms. Bamberger, if you've finished responding to Mr. Justice Rehnquist, I'd like to ask a question. You've emphasized privacy. Does that mean that you would take the same position if the room were, say, the size of an ordinary double room in a small-town hotel with twin beds? Do you object to the fact that two people are in the same room?
No, sir. There is no objection to that, and the record doesn't present that in this case.
What are the dimensions of these cells? I know they're in the record, but I can't put my hand on
them. They're about 75 square feet.
Well, what are the dimensions?
It's
30 feet long and how many feet wide? I thought I saw some...
Yes, they are in the supplemental appendix.
30 feet wide. Well, they can't be much over
10 by 7. Excuse me,
Your Honor? They can't be much over 10 by 7 and a half.
That's right. My math is not too good.
But what are they?
Approximately 10 by 7 and a half.
You're lying on the Chief Justice or
yeah,
the
well,
record?
I think he's good authority. Now, in this room, the toilet juts about 2 feet into the center of the room.
Is that opposite the bunks?
I'm sorry?
Is the toilet opposite the bunks?
Well, it's not exactly opposite because it's into the middle of the room. So that if the bunk bed were on the side where the toilet juts out toward, the bottom bunk would be just inches from the toilet. And the other end of the bed would be at the window.
How far is the mattress on the top bunk from the ceiling?
That fact is not in the record, Your Honor.
But I thought you knew because you said that one couldn't turn over and one couldn't...
No, it wasn't the ceiling height, Your Honor, that was of significance. It was the height of the ventilation, the vent, which supplied the air that went in and out of the room.
The cold air is what prevents one from turning over.
That's right. It's about 1 foot above the body level that the judge found of a person lying
and
on the bed.
How wide are the bunks?
There's only one piece of evidence in the record which would indicate that, and that was one of our experts who testified that the bunks were 6 feet by 3 feet. 6 feet long by 3 feet wide.
So a bunk 3 feet wide in a room 7.5 feet wide would leave 4.5 feet, and you said the people couldn't pass each other.
Well, the aisle is the judge found that it was approximately 30 square feet in width. 30 square feet, so it would be four if it were.
The square feet wouldn't necessarily affect the width of the room. It would depend on how they were structured.
No, that's correct. So if it were 10, it would be 3 feet.
But my point is, you were saying they couldn't pass each other.
Well, it's about 3 feet wide, the width of the aisle that was left in the room.
It would be tight, but your math is a little different from mine. Perhaps you're right.
In any case, the judge made a specific finding that space would make it very crowded and very difficult to move about.
Are the rooms rectangular in shape? I think some of these facilities have triangular rooms.
They're not triangular. They're irregular because of the way the fixtures for plumbing and electricity cut into the room. These are all in an exhibit one to the government's 9G statement, and they are exhibits before the court. And so the scheme of the room with the placement of the articles is in there. The government also relies upon a distortion of the Second Circuit's case to make its argument here. The Second Circuit said that even though there was a compelling interest not to be punished by conditions which were more severe than necessary in order to justify appearance in court and the security of the institution, the particular intrusion imposed by the government had to affect a substantial intrusion, so that even the application of the Second Circuit's compelling interest test would leave the government enormous amounts of room in which to function without returning to the court each time it had to make a decision. And indeed, that is what Judge Kaufman said in his opinion on page 2A of the petition, certiorari petition appendix. Judge Kaufman says twice that the intrusions must be substantial ones. And I think that the government fears about their returning to court for every time they have something to do with just simply unfounded. There are four other issues which were presented to this court by the government. The question of the anal and genital cavity perusals after each visit. I believe my time is up.
No, that's just your five-minute warning.
Sorry. Anal and genital cavity perusals after every visit in a context of enormous security precautions, searches, strip searches which required the inmate to completely disrobe. The second issue presented by the government relates to the total prohibition on all written material to all inmates in the institution except those coming from the publisher.
The reason for that was to prevent drugs and weapons from being concealed in a book and related matters, is it not?
That is true, but the district court found and the Court of Appeals agreed that there were less restrictive, not so overbroad measures which could control that.
Maybe we should make the district judge or some judge the director of the institution.
No, Your Honor, and in fact the district court completely disowned that responsibility, as did the Court of Appeals. They found inappropriate as overbroad only the most extreme measures imposed by the government.
You regard it as an extreme measure to prohibit books being handed to the prisoners without inspection?
Oh, yes, but the court said they could inspect. What the government was doing here is that they were totally prohibiting it. We asserted that they could search. They could limit the quantity. They could limit the amount that comes in each month. They could say only one, only two, but they couldn't totally prohibit. That was what the courts were getting at, that the restrictions which the government imposed were way beyond what was needed to protect their security interests. And based on the evidence in large part from the government's own witnesses, The courts below found that their restrictions on First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendment rights were far more than was necessary to protect the interest, that intermediate interests or intermediate regulations which involved less restrictions but could nevertheless protect the government's security interests could be imposed. And this did not prevent the government from using reasonable means. The choice was there. They could do whatever they chose to do to protect their interests as long as the restriction that was ultimately found to be used by the government was not so overbroad that it went beyond what was necessary to protect the interest.
May I ask two related questions? First, I'm not clear. The regulations that are challenged here, were they just for the New York institution or are they the nationwide regulations of the Bureau of Prisons?
Yes.
That's the first question. Let me give you the second one. You can answer them both together. The second question is the strip search problem. Does the record show that every time there's a visit to an inmate, there's a strip search, or is it done spasmodically?
It's done every single time.
Every single time.
Regardless notwithstanding that the government has enormous search processes, the strip search is still required.
The answer is yes, in other words.
Yes.
Tell me the answer first.
Now, with respect to the nationality or the nationwide application of the rules, the government's publisher-only rule has national application. And indeed, the government has indicated here that they don't even need that broad rule, that they're going to narrow the rule. I'm not aware of the general applicability of the strip search or of the other two. The government's draft standards, by the way, indicate that observed visits need not result in anal and genital perusals in every situation without cause. And our assertion here is that, and the record establishes beyond any doubt, that these visits are observed. There's a guard. A guard takes the inmate into the visiting room. There's a guard that constantly observes the visiting room. The laboratories are not available to inmates. A visitor using the laboratory needs to have a key. There's a door in the laboratory room. The inmates wear jumpsuits. And the testimony was uncontradicted that contraband could not be inserted while wearing those jumpsuits.
Well, the government quoted some witness that said diametrically the contrary, said yes, they could be.
No, well, the government and we apparently have disputed to the significance of that testimony. However, the district court did make a finding that these perusals were not necessary and that there were alternative means, and that therefore I think we can infer that every fact which was not found against us was found for us. The government does not claim that our interpretation was clearly erroneous. What their witness was talking about was the ability to hide things orally and swallow them, which certainly wouldn't be covered by anal and genital inspections. The question of the total prohibition on property from outside the institution is not nationally applied. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bamberger. You have about 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. First of all, with regard to the testimony of government experts in other cases about the amount of space that's necessary, the other case was a case that involved a cell in which people were locked for substantial portions of the day. It is central to the concept of the MCC, and it bears repeating, that people are not locked into their rooms except during sleeping hours. So the inconveniences that we're talking about in this case of two people being in cramped quarters, and we don't deny that the quarters are cramped, is an inconvenience in terms of forced togetherness that exists for a period, a relatively brief period, and in fact essentially none of the waking hours except when there are certain times when everybody has to go to their rooms for a cell count. Now, there was no hearing in this case, not only to hear the government's justifications for resorting to double bunking, but also no hearing to examine the effect of double bunking on the inmates. The only evidence that was before the district court in this case was the affidavit of the government psychiatrist who had examined the facility and who concluded that there was no substantial evidence that this was emotionally detrimental under the conditions that existed at the MCC. Now, the response to this is, on the part of both the district court and the Court of Appeals, in large part was, we already settled this in another case. The other case in which they already settled it, and the Court of Appeals made a revealing error in their original opinion. At page 18A of the appendix, they stated, inmate testimony revealed that double celling had produced numerous disagreements over the choice of activities within the room, had spawned fights, charges of theft, frequent involuntary contact. That was testimony, as they later amended the opinion, in another case. The other case was a case in which there were 40 square feet for two inmates instead of 76 or 77, as in this case. The other case was a case in which the inmates were locked in their room for approximately twice the time that they were in this case. The other case was the conventional cell block kind of jail.
Mr. Fry, were you the government denied the right to put on testimony?
Summary judgment was granted against us. We submitted affidavits. The district court went to the jail, visited it, and said, as people have been known to say about obscenity, it's unconstitutional, I know it when I see it. This we consider to be an unsatisfactory way of dealing with this issue. And I would like at this point to get back to the question of punishment. One thing that's very important, you asked why are we inquiring into fiscal and administrative reasons for the double bunking.
Nobody in the lower courts has based any decision on the grounds that what happened here was punishment. That was not the basis of the decision. That is the argument of the respondents in an effort to surmount the lack of authority to support the Court of Appeals' conclusion that a compelling necessity standard was appropriate to judge the restriction on the liberty of the inmates that was involved. The Court of Appeals did not say this was punishment. Now, they say it's punishment, but they do not analyze the concept in the way this court has analyzed it. That is, they do not look to the standards in Mendoza-Martinez that suggest how you go about the inquiry of determining whether or not something is punishment. And we think if you applied that inquiry in this case, you would not conclude that what happened here was punishment. So I come back to the point that the role...
It's your submission that unless or until there's a finding that this amounts to punishment, the due process clause is not implicated?
Well, our argument is that unless or until there is a finding that there is a lack of a reasonable relationship under whatever level of judicial scrutiny might be given to the government's justification between the practice of double bunking and the government legitimate governmental objectives that might support that practice, the practice stands.
Well, then, in other words, you don't accept the theory suggested in my question. You think that it violates the due process clause even if it's not punishment.
We think that it could, but that is because we don't think the concept of punishment has a useful role to play in analyzing the due process.
Well, how is the due process clause implicated? Well, obviously, I think everybody would agree that government cannot punish somebody until or unless he's convicted of a criminal offense beyond a reasonable doubt. And therefore, you can't take a pretrial detainee and whip him or do anything else that's obviously punishment.
Right.
Now, that would clearly implicate the due process clause of, in this case, of the Fifth Amendment. But absent a finding of punishment, how is the due process clause involved?
Well, that now depends upon what view you take. The view that you have taken in the Moore case, I believe, and perhaps in other places, is that it has to be one of a specific category of interests that are fundamental and that are subjected to searching scrutiny, and punishment would be such an interest.
Constitution, and in order to find the answer to a constitutional question, you look at the Constitution, don't you?
Well, I understood the Moore case to suggest that there were five votes on this court, at least, for the proposition that the due process concept is a rational continuum, in Justice Harlan's words, and that does not include just a series of points that are pricked out. In our view, of course, it doesn't matter to the disposition of this case. We were entitled to a hearing to show the reasons why and to explore the effects of the conditions.
Well, if it's punishment, all the reasons in the world wouldn't make this constitutional, would it? If you showed there are good reasons to whip these people twice a day.
I agree. If it's punishment, we would
then
not
there
be
would be no
defending.
Defense at all, constitutionally.
That's
I think
correct.
If you concede, though, if the cells were if they had 10 square feet in them and two people, just room for two chairs, and they kept them in there 24 hours a day, do you think you could be enjoined from doing
yes.
that?
Yes.
On the grounds of the due
be.
Process clause?
Well, yes, on the grounds of the due process clause. Now, there are two separate ways, however, to look at the due process analysis. One is an importation of the Eighth Amendment standard into the due process clause. And the second is to view it independently as a liberty interest not to be subjected to
That involves punishment, doesn't it? The Eighth Amendment.
Well, the court
that means
has,
finding some that there's some punishment.
The court has I think, the courts have approached that concept in a pragmatic way. That is, they are prepared to say that conditions of confinement that fall below minimal standards of decency
Let me get one thing straight. I take it you would be making the same argument here if this facility had been designed the way it's been used.
Well,
that, it perhaps isn't irrelevant, but it isn't crucial that it was planned to hold X number and all of a sudden it had to hold 2X.
The case might be different because the Court of Appeals made its per se prohibition turn upon the design quality of the or aspect of the case. It was designed for one person. They said you cannot put two people in a room designed for one.
Well, I'm...
My question still is, if it had been designed the way it had been used, you would still be here defending it.
We would defend it, of course.
We would have won in the Court of Appeals.
We might have won in the Court of Appeals. That was the point I was trying to make.
With respect to the publisher-only rule, you indicate in your briefs, as I remember, that the government has now changed its practice and policy and does no longer enforce such a rule with respect to paperback books.
That's correct.
And that, therefore, to that extent, you're not complaining, you're not asking that the Court of Appeals judgment be disturbed in that aspect.
No, that's correct.
Now, how about the more general change of conditions in the overcrowding in this facility?
Well,
isn't it, don't you represent to us now that there is no more overcrowding?
We have explained to the court that we have been able to comply with the outstanding injunction because the number of pretrial detainees has, at present, is dramatically lower than it was
still complaining.
2 years ago. We still take the position, the population in the institution at present is fluctuating at or near 449 people. The present capacity...
It was designed for 449.
It was designed for 449. The present capacity in terms of numbers of beds is higher because there are 30 extra beds in the dormitory, right. So actually up to 479 could be held. In fact, as a practical matter, you can't always do it because you have classifications. That is, you have a unit for women. Male prisoners are not put in that unit. You might have 10 empty beds in there that you simply can't use, and there are other kinds of problems like that. But it is our position that an injunction has been issued against us that we believe is improper and unauthorized and without constitutional basis, and that we would, if the need arose again, and it may, resort to double bunking.
So you would vigorously object to any suggestion that this case is moot?
Well, I don't know. I don't. We would object to a disposition that involved, let's say, a dismissal of the writ. I don't know that we would object to a disposition of vacating the injunction and remanding it. We just think that under the, I think United States against W.T. Grant is a case which indicates that it would not be moot where we say that we will again do what the injunction prohibited. I don't know in the district court when it gets back there, if you do reverse, whether there'll be a meaningful controversy, because I don't know how the district court is going to decide whether double bunking is justified at a time when it's not.
But it doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist.
Mr. Tryon, do I understand the government concedes or is taking no position on the question of whether a writ of habeas corpus is subject to a class action?
Well, I...
Isn't that a very important question?
It may be a very important question. My understanding, and when I made inquiry about that, I was advised that there is some Court of Appeals authority to the effect that
none here.
Habeas class action. There is none here. I'm simply...
Don't you think that's an important question in this case?
I think it's an important question. I don't think it's an important question in this case because we didn't raise it. And so while perhaps it would have been an important question that we might have raised, I don't mean to be facetious. I'm not clear that it's before the court presently for decision.
Well, if there's no jurisdiction, it's before the court, whether anyone's raised it or not.
Well, but there is a distinction between the subject matter jurisdiction in habeas corpus over a claim and the question of whether a class action was improperly certified. We do have another
petition
pending. But
it's one that deserves some exploration. Would you not agree?
Well, we would be prepared if the court wants us to research the question and submit our views on it.
We'll pass on that later. We'll resume arguments at 1 o'clock, but subject to Mr. Justice White's question.
Now?
Yes. He won't be back at 1 o'clock.
Well, he might if you ask him.
I will.
Mr. Fry, do you think the issue on the books is moot? Is that what you're suggesting?
No, we're not suggesting that at all.
What are you suggesting?
We are suggesting that we are not requesting relief except as regards hardcover
books.
Well,
you raised this question in your petition.
We have raised it in
and
our petition.
And you briefed it?
Well, at the time that we briefed it, the policy had already been changed, and our briefing was intended to focus
so
on
the hardcover. So does that mean that the issue has become moot since the filing of the petition for certiorari?
I think it if the hardcover books were not involved, if the injunction had been issued only against softcover books, then I think the issue would be moot, as I was saying earlier, because
and
we would have no intention.
And the injunction would then be vacated to that extent?
I guess. I'm not sure that it would really matter. So.
Thank you. Case is submitted.
Thank you.